This is an ABC podcast.
Georgina Reed grew up with a big, rambling family garden. And right from when she was a kid, with dirt under her fingernails, something about plants got under Georgina's skin. Despite her mum's warnings, Georgina became a landscape designer. And she's travelled around the world talking to other gardeners about the worlds that they've created in their own backyards. Places to sweat and to toil in, to lie back and dream in. Gardens full of mistakes and failures, but also full of surprises and delights. Her book is called The Plant Hunter: Truth, Beauty, Chaos and Plants. Hi, Georgina.
Hi, Sarah.
Tell me about your garden first. Where is it?
I live in a really small little settlement on the side of the Hawkesbury River, just north of Sydney.
And what's it look like, your garden?
It's kind of a disaster. It is... Oh, look, Sarah, when we got there about 18 months ago, it hadn't been touched for 30 years. So it was completely wild. There was like lantana, maybe 2 or 3 metres tall. It was so mysterious. Like, you could hardly see the house from the side of the river. Actually, I don't think you could. There were so many trees and so it's just so much wilderness. Now we know that there's actually a pathway leading up from the boat shed to the house, which we didn't know when we bought it. We just thought it was like there was nothing there. So it was that wild. And I loved that because, you know, there's a sense of romance and mystery and you kind of don't know what's there. We kept uncovering things like tanks, picnic tables, all of this stuff. But then, you know, there were weeds. There were big, big, fat, ugly weeds on the side of a national park and we had to really get rid of them. So now it's kind of a bit bare and a bit wallaby ravaged and it's kind of lost a bit of the romance, but it's also like full of hope and wonder to me.
Do you have a vision inside your own head about what this garden might look like in 10 years, 20 years?
I sort of do and I sort of don't. And my partner, I mean, because my background is landscape design, my partner at the start kept saying, "So George, when are you going to draw up the plans? When am I going to see the plans?" And I was like, "Oh, darling, come on, you know, I just can't do it, you know. I mean, I've spent so much time doing that for other people and I have like a really vague vision, but I also, this is my first garden and the more time I spend there, the more I just want to sit in it and be in it and let it tell me where it wants to go and what to do there in a way, which sounds a bit romantic, but it's sort of working. And there's also some structure there as well. So it's not a complete blank canvas. So in our uncovering and in our weeding, we discovered all of these old sandstone walls. So someone had actually really loved this garden a long time ago. And we've got walls and a few stairs and things like that that are all nice old kind of half falling down things. But the actual reality is I impulse buy plants and then I sort of bring them back and throw them in a little bit. So, you know, there's big picture dreaming and big picture ideas of how I want the space to feel. And then there's kind of compulsive gardening and compulsive planting. But it'll be mostly native given the situation that it's in.
Do you have an emotional connection to the plants that you put there in your garden?
Oh, yeah. Like now I've got a whole bunch running down the side of our entry pathway, which goes down to the boat shed, which is where I work. And because we've just had rain, we've had quite a bit of rain. And so every day I walk down and I kind of say hello to each of them and check on them because they're all growing and it's amazing. I'm always amazed by plants and I think I'm just always in love with them.
What was the garden like in your family home when you were growing up?
It was pretty big. Mum was always tinkering in it, and I think we all were really. So we had an old farmhouse and the garden sort of started off fairly small around that, and then as Mum got gardening, of course, it got bigger and a bit bigger and bigger. So sort of informal and but just lovely.
What kind of work did you do there to help out with her or learn from her?
I was always doing stuff with her. I remember planting seeds, like seed mixes in the garden near the back door, or helping her make veggie gardens at the back there with like the layers of compost and cow manure and loosened hay and cardboard raised gardens. I made a weed garden once, which she was not particularly impressed
with. What do you mean by a weed garden?
She gave my brother and I space at the back of the veggie patch, and I think she intended for us to grow veggies. And I just decided, like, seeing how the weeds were so happy, I just thought that I would grow the weeds. So we transplanted all the weeds. I enlisted my poor younger brother's help, and we transplanted them out of Mum's garden. So we did her a service, I guess, and we stuck them in our weed garden at the end. And then I think she wasn't that impressed.
No, though I think I've grown a few weed gardens in my time. Yeah, they definitely can be easier to tend than vegetables.
Right. It's a good approach, really.
How did things in your mum's garden compare to your grandma's garden?
My grandma's garden was in town. She lived on the farm next door to ours for a long time and then moved into town when my grandfather died. And Granny was she's quite a tough gardener. She's a tough woman. Like, she always had the vegetables. She always had the sweet peas growing up the wall. And she had the pretty things, the pretties, she'd call them, out the front. But everything was kind of, you know, it had to behave or there would be a bit of a reprimand in some way. So she'd be often having, like, wars on ants or wars on snails or something like that when I'd be visiting her.
How did your mum and dad react when you told them you wanted to make plants your job?
Well, they're quite conservative people, and they, you know, they thought it was good that we go to university and, you know, do something sort of sensible, and which I'd done, so I'd ticked that box. And then when I went back and was like, oh, I don't know about my university degree, I'm going to go and do horticulture at TAFE. They were kind of a bit, like, my mum was like, oh God, you're never going to have any money, you're going to, you know, are you sure about this, really? And so they were a bit concerned, I think, for me. But I think they realised I was serious. And then so I went back. I went up one weekend and they were a bit concerned. And then it must have been a month or so later, I'd come back and I decided that that's what I was going to do. And I found a pair of red Felco secateurs under my pillow from my mum, which is just like, they're just my most favourite things, my most treasured possession, really.
So you got the seal of approval. Do you think of what you do as gardening or horticulture or design? I mean, what label do you feel resonates most with your approach?
Well, actually, now I just call myself a gardener. When I first finished studying landscape design and horticulture, I was working in a landscape architecture firm, and I would always think that I sounded much better if I called myself a landscape designer. That was my thing. And then now I think, actually, I'm a gardener, and that's a really important thing to do, and that's something that I should be proud of, and I am.
Is the way a garden looks the most important thing to you?
No, it's the feeling. Some gardens, it's like, you know, there's pretty, and pretty's great. So you can make a nice picture, and you can have the composition right, and you can have the line, everything can be pleasing. And that's a great thing, but to create something that's got a real sense of depth and beauty, you need more than a pretty picture, and you need that element of atmosphere and emotion and magic that a garden can potentially evoke. And that, for me, doesn't come necessarily from, you know, great composition or great lines or a really expensively designed garden. For me, that actually comes from the magic that's created when a person gardens that space. So it's really about the energy between the hand of the gardener and the space itself.
You've gone and met a bunch of gardeners, people who, like you, are obsessed with plants. Let's start with Kevin Forrest. Is that the name that his parents gave him?
No, it's not.
How did he come to be known as Kevin, spelt C-E-V-A-N, Forrest?
Well, he changed his name, I think, when he was maybe in his early 20s. So he had a pretty rough family life, I think. It wasn't a particularly happy place to be. One of his friends was good with numerology, I think. So Kevin decided that a new name meant that he could create a new world for himself, a new life for himself. So he did.
Had gardens and plants always been important to him?
Yeah, always. So as I said, his family life was a bit tough, but he says he was quite an easy child because they could just stick him outside in the garden and he'd be happy all day.
He was a bit of a plant prankster as a teenager. What did he get up to with a juniper tree?
So one day, I think one night, I'm assuming, he decided to steal a juniper tree from one of the front yards of in his neighbourhood, And he took it home and put it in a pot and bonsaied it and spent a few years bonsaiing the tree, as you do when you're, I don't know, 13, 14-year-old boy. Then, you know, at one point he got sick of it. So one night, a few years later, he returned it to its previous home in a pot on the front veranda and left it there.
What was Kevin wearing when you visited him?
Kevin was wearing a towel around his waist when he opened the front door or gate of his home in San Jose.
So what's it like as you step off the streets of San Jose and he's opened that gate? What greets you as you walk inside his garden?
Oh, my God. Kevin's garden is, I think it's actually indescribable. It's very hard to communicate the otherworldliness of that space. So picture like a really standard suburban street in America, you know, just the grass out the front, pretty houses, everything just as it is. And then Kevin's front yard has got quite a big kind of timber fence along the front of it, big old kind of antique timber gates that you can't see through at all. And then, you know, walking through those, it's like, it is actually another world. So he's got a tiny little old timber house in the middle of it. And around that is just this mad landscape, layer upon layer upon layer of like old stone columns from buildings in San Francisco that were knocked down in the 60s, 1,000-year-old horse troughs from China, rock wall kind of things everywhere, trees, orchids growing out of wall. It just like, it's beyond kind of explanation, really.
So does it look like just some crazy jumble, or does it have some kind of unity to it when you visit?
Oh, it's got unity. It's incredibly beautiful. No, he's got an incredible eye. So it's not a jumble in the slightest. It feels very cohesive, and it feels, I guess the thing about it is it just feels like another world completely, completely.
What happens to that space at night? How is it a different place to be in when the sun goes down?
It's pretty, I mean, it's wild. And pretty dark. He's got this crazy lighting. It's pretty hard to find your way in and out, I would say, especially after his very big glasses of vodka and a big dinner. I mean, yeah, it's got quite an air of mystery in the evenings.
Tell me about Leslie Bennett. What sort of life was she leading before she became a gardener?
Leslie was a lawyer in London writing agricultural policy.
So does that mean she was familiar with agriculture and farming and that sort of gardening?
Turns out she wasn't very familiar, and she was told by a very no-nonsense English farmer that before she kept writing about farms, she better get herself out and see one for herself and spend time on one. So she did.
And what did that? How did that change the life she was leading?
It completely changed her life. So she says that she was clinically depressed as a lawyer. She was really unhappy. She hated her job. And she started going to farms. She eventually went to Jamaica, which is where her father's was from, and spent time working on a farm there. So she found herself in the soil, really.
You visited a garden that Leslie created south of San Francisco. What was her brief for that garden?
That garden was owned by a family, and they had a young daughter who was autistic, and they firmly believe in the idea of food as medicine and health, eating healthily and well. So they had an old tennis court there that they knocked down and turned into a vegetable garden designed by Leslie. I think initially the brief was the food, but Leslie is very much about beauty and productivity. So, you know, she says productive gardens shouldn't just be about feeding the stomach, they should also be about feeding the soul. And you know, why can't those two things coexist? Which often in productive gardens, beauty is kind of sacrificed for this idea of productivity, which is the god. So this garden, I think, began it as a purely productive garden, but it's incredibly beautiful. It's so beautiful. And the family, I think, spend a lot of time there, and they get a lot out of it because of that.
As you say, Leslie's dad is Jamaican. Does race play a part in the way that she approaches gardening and thinks about it?
Yeah, I think it really informs the way she thinks about gardening. And, you know, she spoke about when she was working on organic farms, she was always the only person of colour working on these farms. And, you know, she says there's a lot of race and class and bigger issues tied up in that. But she is really interested in what it is to create spaces for healing for black women. She says black women in America right now are carrying a really heavy burden, and you know, they need somewhere to go, to connect to the earth, to connect to each other and to feel at peace. And so she's started, as part of her work now, creating those kind of healing gardens, those spaces for black women.
Moving south out of the US, where is Beverly McConnell's garden?
Beverly, she's in Whitford, which is just east of Auckland in New Zealand.
And her garden, how big is it?
16 acres.
That's substantial.
It's big.
How did it begin? What was the story behind her garden?
Well, she got married to a man called Malcolm, and I think in the 60s they bought that property, because she said when they got married she had one rule, and that was she wasn't moving to the city. So if he wanted to marry her, they had to live in the country. So he obliged, and they bought this property and fenced off, I think, 3 acres around the house. I think it was a dairy farm. It was a paddock, so there was no real garden there. And she soon changed that dramatically.
Well, she and Malcolm, Bev and Malcolm, took a trip to England together fairly early on. How did that change the way they wanted to plant or what they wanted to do in that garden?
They had like this 3-acre garden, thought that was enough. And then they went to Hampton Court Palace, which has got, you know, big fountains and lakes and all of that. There's a lot of water going on there. And Malcolm decided then and there that they needed some water in their garden called Airlie's. So they did. And also while they were there, they found a gardener and they bought a gardener back called Oliver.
In their hand luggage.
In their hand luggage. I know, it sounds a bit mad, doesn't it? But no, they employed a gardener and invited him back out to Airlie's, and he's still there now. He's retired. I think he's retired 3 or 4 times, but he's still around.
So that's a particular sort of garden where you're able to, you know, import a gardener and a garden of that size. Yeah. Is Bev herself physically involved? Has she been in the creation of the garden, or is it more a, you know, do this, plant this, dig up that?
No, Bev really was in the garden. This is her, like, life dream project, really. So, you know, she was saying, oh, you've got to be fit to lug all those rocks around. And I neglected the kids a little bit. She had 5 kids. It's like I spent a lot of time in the garden. I don't really think they minded, you know. So she was, and she's still there now. When we were leaving, she's like, I spent an hour digging up that stuff the other day. I can't do any more than that because, you know, it gets a bit much, but, you know, she's still going.
So what's it like to walk through Airlie's? What kind of garden is it for a visitor?
It's an incredible garden. I mean, it's huge. But the spaces there, you know, they're really quite intimate, and there's a magic in a lot of them, which always appeals to me. So it's kind of got, like, often with large gardens, you lose a bit of the intimacy and the scale, which really, you know, makes the enclosure that often makes a garden feel quite special and quite heartening, I guess. But Bev's is huge, but it's still got the heart in it, which of course I loved. I think scale in those kind of gardens is really, really important. And Bev, you know, she's got a background, she studied art at university. She's got a great eye for colour and also for composition, most definitely.
Someone like that who married, has 5 children, a lot going on in their life, what is it that would bring her such energy and focus on a garden of that size? I mean, it sounds like a lifelong obsession or activity. Why?
You know, the more time you spend caring for a place, the more you see, you know, this place that you've nurtured grow beauty and grow and evolve and respond to your touch. It's like, you know, it's like a love relationship in a way. The more you give to a garden space, the more you'll get out of it. And, you know, that garden is absolutely her. I mean, not to say it's above her husband and kids, but it's absolutely her lifelong passion, without a doubt.
If you met Bev in downtown Auckland, would you be able to pick her as a gardener?
I think so. Yeah.
What are the giveaways?
Well, the hands. Scott Gardner's hands. She probably, actually, when we did our interview with her, we walked around with her. She came out of the house with the secateurs in her hand. Like, she was, I think they're firmly fixed. So, yeah, gardeners always have great hands, always a bit of dirt under the nails and just kind of all the wrinkles, all the good stuff. And also, there's always a sparkle in the eye of a gardener. Like, I think my grandmother had it, and Bev definitely has it. It's this, when you spend so much time in the garden and surrounded by beauty and connecting with the natural world around you, you can't help but be kind of imbued with this sense of awe and wonder. And it goes with you. You take it with you wherever you go. And I think that shows, that sparkles in the eyes.
Tell me about the garden that Sue Miles created.
So Sue had quite a big garden up in Warunga, which is in the northern suburbs of Sydney. And I think it was around an acre. And her husband bought it in the 50s and built the house and started making a garden. And Sue was a camellia collector. There's a lot of camellias in the garden. They run all the way down this very long driveway. And, you know, it's sort of a 1950s camellia collector's garden, if that makes sense, if you get a visual for that. So camellias, hydrangeas, azaleas, weeping cherries, all of those.
Pretty flowers.
Kind of pretty flowers. And her son, Peter, grew up there, and he also is now he's a garden designer as well now, and a great gardener and incredibly lovely man. And when Sue started getting old in her 80s, Peter started confiscating tools from her.
Why?
Because I think he went up there once and she was a bit stiff and sore, and he's like, "Mom, what have you been doing?" She's like, "Oh, it's just sticking up privet roots all day and my back's a bit sore." And so he took the mattock away from her, and I think other tools followed. So he started taking Sue's tools away and then started caring for this garden himself.
And once he started getting involved, how did the garden change?
It started getting a little bit more bromeliad-y, if that's a word, a bit more tropical. So Peter had a bit of an obsession with bromeliads and epiphytic plants and those kind of things.
It sounds like the garden started to look quite different. How did his mum feel about that?
Oh, she was such a sweetheart. She passed away a few months ago, which is a bit sad. She was 98. She was so gracious. So Peter was really, when we sat down on the veranda with Peter and Sue, and Sue had her little notebook out where she'd written all of the little notes about the garden that she wanted to talk to us about. And Peter, I think, just felt, he was kind of mortified. I think he just felt like he'd really broken Sue's heart, because he'd started, you know, he'd hung this incredible old weeping cherry with all of these bromeliads and Ripsalis, which is like an epiphytic jungle cactus thing, and air plants and all of these weird and wonderful things. And Sue was, yeah, she was gracious. She said, "Peter, it's okay. You know, you've taken over with my blessing. It's okay."
Do people show you a different side of themselves in their garden when you talk to them in that space that they've created?
Often. I think people, I mean, for me personally, I'm most myself when I'm in my garden, and I think that's actually the power of gardens in a way, is that they take the delusions away a little bit, you know, all of the noise and the rush and the ideas that we might have about who we are and where we are in the world. Well, when I'm in my garden particularly, those things, they don't mean anything. You know, I'm talking to the plants, I'm seeing what's happening here, I'm watching, I'm observing, I'm kind of in awe. And I think that's what I get to see when I'm in a garden with someone else, is them engaged in that and being, I think, mostly their true selves, which is, again, quite a joy.
Do you think about what will happen to these extraordinary gardens after the people who've created them are gone?
I do, but I think, you know, a garden, like my grandmother's garden, for example, she died in 2013, and we went back to her place a month or two after, and it was spring, and just being in her garden and seeing the calendulas, like, taking over the garden path and all of this stuff that she would never have let happen. Like, the garden was completely full and abundant and wild in a way that Granny would never have allowed. It was so incredibly beautiful and so heartbreaking in a way that she wasn't there to see it. But also, that's its next thing. that's where it's going to. So you can't hold on to things, I guess.
Georgina, it's been just delightful talking to you about gardens. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thank you for having me, Sarah.
You're listening to Conversations with Sarah Kanoski on ABC Radio.
Georgina Reed's book is called The Plant Hunter. abc.net.au/conversations is our website. Don't forget, you can listen to Conversations anytime through the ABC Listen app. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.